Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
A grim anniversary in Paris, 10 years after the attack at the Bataclan. We hear from the father of one of those killed, who remembers his son as much more than the victim of that terrible crime.
And Inns on the Outs. We'll ponder the fate of the room rental chain Sonder with a guest whose accommodations abruptly turned unaccommodating when the company suddenly went kaput this week, leaving his family to collect their luggage that had been strewn around the hallway.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Thursday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at AtchisonTire.com. The Crossing Arts Alliance in Brainerd has an opening reception for this year's Kringle Market tomorrow from 5 to 7. Find unique crafts, cards, and gifts made by dozens of local artists. And we receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is the Olympians with the song California. And that's the Olympians with the song California.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
power play, energy production in the Arctic is on Prime Minister Carney's latest list of nation-building projects. I'll speak with the woman in charge of the Inuit-owned Clean Energy Corporation with big plans for Iqaluit.
Coming down the pipe, it may have Indigenous backing, but a liquefied natural gas facility fast-tracked by Ottawa is facing tough opposition from several First Nations in BC.
Working through his emotional baggage, when a room rental company suddenly went bankrupt, an Arkansas man found his family's suitcases unceremoniously dumped in the hall. But he tells us that was not about to stop them from staying the night.
Praying for rain. As Iran suffers through its worst drought in decades, all possibilities are on the table for the city of Tehran, population 10 million, including total evacuation.
Darkness in the City of Light. Paris marks the 10th anniversary of the massacre at the Bataclan. Our guest tells us he still cannot bring himself to go to the ceremony at the site where his son was killed.
And a leg up. They clipped her wings to keep her at a wildlife sanctuary in England, but a young flamingo tested those wings by escaping and flying all the way to France, and they passed with flying colors. As it happens, the Thursday edition, Radio That Guesses, she gave them the pink slip. Today, Prime Minister Mark Carney unveiled his latest list of what his government has termed nation-building projects. And one of those new endeavors has the potential to transform energy in the Canadian Arctic.
Today, we're referring the Iqaluit Nuqiqsutsit Hydro Project to the Major Projects Office. This is a breakthrough. This is a breakthrough for Arctic sovereignty and sustainability. It will save $1.9 billion in diesel costs over the next 50 years while providing affordable, reliable, emissions-free power in the Arctic.
The federal government is investing in building a hydroelectric power plant along the Kugaloo River near Iqaluit. If it gets built, it could replace all of Iqaluit's diesel-generated electricity, which comes from southern Canada and the United States. The company leading the project is Nunavut Nuqiqsauti Corporation, an Inuit-owned clean energy developer. Heather Shilton is its executive director, and we reached her in Iqaluit.
Heather, from where you sit, what will what we heard from the Prime Minister today mean for people in Iqaluit?
So we import about 16 million liters of diesel every single year and burn that for electricity generation, which not only causes increased exhaust, which leads to sort of toxic exhaust hanging over our homes, but it also contributes to some of the highest electricity rates in the country. So some of the goals that we have for this project is to stabilize those costs and reduce them as much as possible, and then also avoid those greenhouse gas emissions that we get from our diesel power plant currently.
What about you personally? How do you feel about it?
I'm certainly quite excited about it. This is a long time coming. This project was initiated back in 2005 by our utility, so it's almost sort of 20 years in the making. I've been working on this project myself for about 6 years now, and we've really been given the opportunity from Inuit leadership here and support from the federal government to re-envision what the clean energy transition can look like in the territory. And through this sort of made in Nunavut approach that we have to development to ensure that Inuit voices are centered every step of the way, I think we are moving in the right direction.
Was there a point you thought it's not going to happen?
Well, I think there's still a lot of work to be done yet. We still have to go through the regulatory process to advance this project, and there is a territorial process that we have to follow. So we will be going through the Nunavut Impact Review Board, and that will ensure that there is more time and more opportunities for folks in Iqaluit and in Penghu'u and across the territory to voice any concerns, highlight any things that they want us to do differently when we're looking at constructing the project potentially.
cost, of course, is not a small part of this. The estimates are anywhere between $400 million and $500 million. We did not hear a precise dollar commitment from the Prime Minister so far. How much federal funding are you going to need to make this project happen, to make it feasible?
I think one of the things that we are very much looking forward to with this recent announcement is having a single point of contact within the federal government. So there are still a lot of opportunities to identify how the federal government can support the project financially, whether that is through some kind of grant or investment, or it could be through other agreements that support us financially, investment tax credits and other things like that. So there is much to discuss in that space. And I think having this single point of contact and this streamlined approach will help us to identify what this is specifically going to look like moving forward.
The earliest, as I understand it, this could all be up and running there would be 2033. There have been hiccups, to say the least, before, as you know, in 2014. It was deemed too expensive when it was, you know, under the auspices of the territorial government. So does this moment feel different?
Yes, it certainly does. I think it also helps that we are an Inuit-owned organization. So the way that we approach development is not necessarily centered only on economics. So we are driven by Inuit kaimaitikangi, or Inuit societal values, and the cultural importance of the land is just as important as the economic importance of the cost of living. So when we look at a project, we look at that holistic view of what a project can do. And I think that alignment with Inuit values has allowed this project to look a little bit different than a previous iteration of this project. I think there is still quite a bit of work to do to make sure that all of the effects and potential impacts are made well known and folks can make informed decisions about how they want to see this continue to develop.
When you are explaining this to people, pitching it, telling them what's at play, what do you tell them about where the dam is going to be and what you're taking into consideration?
I think one of the important parts about this project was that we did not choose the site. So when we took the project over in 2021, we wanted to look at a number of different options, both sort of technological solutions and location options beyond what had been previously identified by the utility about 10 years ago. And when we looked at those options, we did a techno-economic study, we did an environmental and regulatory study, and we did a Tisaktavut study with the Kikitani Inuit Association to understand land, water, and resource use in the Akharit area. And that allowed us to rank all of these options. And then the results of that ranking was shared with Ekanumu, and we held a vote through community engagement sessions. And the participants in that engagement session, we had multiple of them back in 2023, they were the ones who voted on this site. So this Kugalu site, which is what we are continuing to develop here now, it was selected by Ekanumu. And I think that that process goes a long way because it certainly was not a developer coming in and telling people where things need to go. It was selected by community.
So in your dream scenario, you know, if you let yourself think ahead, you sound very practical and cautiously optimistic about where things go. That's what I'm taking away from the tone in your voice. But in 2033 and beyond, what are you envisioning? What will it be like?
I think the goal is really just to see that diesel power plant shut down for a little bit in Akharit. It is constantly generating electricity, generating noise, generating emissions. So seeing that turned off and having Akharit powered by clean, affordable, and reliable power, I think that's something that will be very exciting to see in a few years' time.
Great to speak with you, Heather. Thank you.
Great. Glad to meet. Thank you.
Heather Shilton is the executive director of Nunavut Nukiksauti Corporation. We reached her in Iqaluit. Tehran is home to around 10 million people, and right now the president of Iran is talking about evacuating that city entirely. Masoud Pezeshkian raised that mind-boggling possibility in a speech on Friday in the face of an escalating water crisis. Iran is in the middle of its worst drought in decades, and the capital has been hit especially hard. Residents are being urged to ration water. But experts say that evacuating or even relocating Tehran is effectively impossible. Kaveh Madani is the director of the UN University Institute for Water, Environment and Health and a former deputy head of Iran's Department of Environment. We reached him in Toronto.
Kaveh, you are from Tehran. You have friends and family there. I'm sure there are a lot of phone calls, WhatsApp messages. What are people telling you about what they're dealing with right now?
I see a state of confusion. On one side, they understand that this is a real problem. The pressure of water has dropped. There are interruptions in water access overnight or some other hours of the day. They see what's going on, the reservoirs, satellite images, and so on. But there's also a state of denial in a way, because it's hard to imagine that the city with so many reservoirs around it, and a city with that guaranteed 100% coverage of clean water at every home is suffering from a situation like this and is now water bankrupt. So lots of frustration and confusion.
When you hear President Pezeshkian talk about a potential evacuation or relocation of Tehran, I mean, what do you make of those words?
The first thing is understand that he wanted to imply that this is a serious issue, because I think the general public has not yet taken this matter seriously. And if it doesn't rain, then the problem is going to get even worse. We are talking about a few days or even weeks of water left for Tehran. Day zero, as we call it in the water sector, is near. It's a day that the taps would run dry. But evacuation is not easy. During the Israel attacks on Iran, President Trump posted on social media and encouraged Tehranis to leave Tehran, and soon he got educated that it's not possible. I was not expecting to see the president of Iran not knowing that. So evacuation is not possible. Relocation also is not something you do overnight, yet the government has had the policy that or a measure that they have tried in the past, that through prolonging weekends, shutting down schools and offices, they encourage people to leave the city during the weekend or those long weekends. And that if you only have a few days of water left, saving even a few hours would make a difference.
In terms of answering the question, how did things get to this point? What happened?
Well, Iran's water bankruptcy problem is nothing new. There are underlying problems. Most importantly, more than 70% of Iran's over 90 million people are in a few metropolitan areas. That sort of human concentration anywhere in the world would cause trouble. There is an inefficient agriculture sector, and it's accountable for not more than 90% of water allocation. It's absolutely inefficient. And then many wrong policies and the lack of appreciation for water being a limit to growth. We have seen it in other countries in the region, where the ambitious leaders in the Middle East got fooled by the oil income and thought that by investing more in technology and over-reliance on technology, they can address their fundamental shortcomings. And we see that that's not the case. But on top of that issue, we have a paralyzing drought. And so it's a catalyst coming on top of that. So the house was already on fire, and climate change and drought are adding fuel to that fire. The flames are everywhere and no longer deniable.
You warned the leadership in Iran about some of these problems when you were deputy head of the country's environment department. When you were raising those concerns, though, it didn't bring on change. It you were detained.
Well, the governments don't listen to scientists or even I was an insider at some point, because it's business as usual is the best strategy for those who want to have a longer life in policymaking, right? So we are hearing warnings about climate change and mismanagement of water everywhere in the world. At least in Canada, you don't get detained or get accused of espionage for the enemy and making up all those stories. Unfortunately, yes, that's how I got penalized for saying those things based on peer-reviewed work and science. But I also understand that those changes are very hard to make. If you have your farmers employed in the agricultural sector and your economy is under sanctions and you're in a war and you have decided to fight with the rest of the world, the only solution you have is burning your natural resources to be able to withstand the pressure. This doesn't mean that I support the policy of fighting with the world, but I'm saying that this is the expected consequence of that. Iran needs to create alternative employment opportunities for their farmers and the rural population in other sectors, and that's a mission impossible unless it can diversify its economy, which cannot be done unless Iran resolves its issues with the West and decides to manage its system differently.
Is there rain in the forecast soon?
Rain can bring a temporary relief. We are not seeing anything significant in terms of forecast. Of course, fortunately, science tells us that still we are not very good in forecasting. So I hope that the reality would be better than what we see. But like, you know, here and there, rain can help. Snow is what they need more than rain. But those are temporary reliefs, right? They're like giving Tylenol to someone who is suffering from infection. It takes the pain away. The headache goes away for a few hours, but the infection keeps getting worse and worse. Iran needs a radical shift in its environmental behavior and water management.
Kaveh, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Kaveh Madani is the director of the UN University Institute for Water, Environment and Health. We reached him in Toronto. They had reservations, and now they have reservations about having made those reservations. Travelers who booked via the short-term rental company Sonder are having a bad week. Hundreds of people in cities from Montreal to Amsterdam to Rome were left stranded on Monday when the Canadian-founded business announced without warning that it had ended its licensing deal with Marriott. It rented about 9,000 spaces in over 40 cities, and it listed them through Marriott's platforms. But that was just the background corporate stuff. The upshot was that a lot of people were told their reservations had been canceled or that they had to leave their rooms immediately. And days later, some of them are still in limbo. Paul Strack was having a good time with family and friends in Boston when the company shut down. We reached him back home in North Little Rock, Arkansas.
Paul, your reason for being in Boston was to take part in the Spartan obstacle race, but is this the kind of ride you were expecting?
No, we encountered obstacles that weren't really listed later on, but it was quite a weekend.
In more ways than one, certainly.
Yes.
Sunday, you get an email. What did it say?
Yeah, we're out about in Boston just enjoying our last couple days, and I did get an email. And I think the subject line was something, attention, Marriott reservations, or something like that. That was the subject line. And I did glance at it and read through it. And so what caught my eye was a sentence or two that said, all those holding reservations will need to leave the premises by 9 a.m. Monday morning. I kind of brushed it off, thought it was either a scam or spam or just a joke. We said, surely not. Because with the Sonder reservations, you pay in advance, and we had paid up through leaving Tuesday, and kind of brushed it off like that.
Then you went back to your room.
Yeah, when we got back to our room on Sunday afternoon, everything's fine, and I just decided I'll go check with the Sonder office. And I spoke to the woman there, and she goes, yeah, we're aware of that email. We don't have a whole lot of answers. We're meeting about it this afternoon. But as of right now, everything is fine. You don't need to do anything.
Oh. So she didn't know anything
either. No, there was no communication on either end. Monday we wake up and we're going to go and our last full day in Boston, enjoy the sights and the sounds and the taste of Boston one last day. And we get back to our room about 5 p.m. As we are walking toward the door, we notice that the deadlock is in the outward protruding position. So our door is not shut. And we thought, well, this is odd. And as soon as we opened the door completely, we noticed all of our suitcases. Again, there's five people in this one 3-bedroom rental. All of our suitcases are in the hallway, not arranged nicely, just kind of strewn about in the hallway. And I immediately started thinking, well, this they really did this. And so we continue to walk through the unit. They've put up everything. They've packed up all of our belongings. They've packed up all our toiletry items from our bathrooms. They've packed up our dirty clothes. Now, if they got them all in the right suitcases, we're not sure yet. And we're just,
We're laughing about it, but this is crazy.
It is. And again, we are laughing about it. I know it affected a lot more people much worse than us. You know, and I know people are out of work and other people are still scrambling, but I go in the kitchen where I had my laptop and I said, hey, guys, my laptop's gone. And everybody who had one said, yeah, where is that? So they took our laptops and electronic devices and put them just in the plastic grocery shopping bags and threw all that in there. And that hit real more than throwing my clothes around, you know. And so I immediately go back to the Sonder office. And typically the Sonder employees are dressed in some type of cohesive uniform. I see four guys just sitting there and they have these forlorn looks on their face and they're just sitting there in street clothes. I was prepared to be angry and plead my case and tell them, you guys, you know, invaded our privacy or whatever. And they go, no, so we know what's going on. And then as of this afternoon, Sonder no longer exists as a company and we've just lost our jobs. And so that kind of disarmed me. I mean, what could I say to that?
Yeah.
And I said, well, so what are we supposed to do? They said, well, we're told to tell you you have to vacate the premises immediately. And I kind of said, well, what if I don't? They said, well, we don't have an answer for that.
And you didn't. You stayed.
And I didn't. I stayed. So I called. I got back to that email, and there was a phone number to call. So they were aware of the situation. They said, sir, what we can do is make you a new reservation. There is a Marriott hotel a couple blocks down. It'll be about $700 a night, which is more than the nightly rate I was paying. I said, no, you should comp it. He said, well, I understand that you will get a refund on the remaining portion of your current reservation.
And why wouldn't why wouldn't you trust them when they say that?
Yeah,
why would
exactly. What frustrated me most about that conversation is there was no empathy or sympathy, very cold, borderline rude, and no help at all. After the phone call, we all said, all right, what are we going to do? Are we going to stick together and become squatters, or are we going to go find some other room? But I said, well, we've paid for this room tonight. So we went to bed, but none of us really got a good night's sleep because every time we heard a noise, we said, oh, no, that's them. They're coming to get us. So,
I mean, yeah, understandable.
Yeah.
We should mention Sonder has a statement on its website that says, quote, it faced severe financial constraints arising from, among other things, prolonged challenges in the integration of the company's systems and booking arrangements with Marriott International, unquote. They go on to say liquidation was the only way to go.
Mm-hmm.
What are the ways that this situation could have been handled better?
I'm in a small business. I own a small business. I know things happen. And I know if there's a severance of employees, it has to be done. It's never pretty. But the communication was so broad and bland, it didn't seem legitimate. I would have thought a phone call, possibly. I lean to Marriott's responsibility, but I get their point that they have nothing to do with Sonder. I would have thought there could have been an individual on the floor saying, hey, we apologize, and this is your option. But just the brazenness to go into our room and pack our belongings like that. And I don't know who that is, which is crazy.
Well, will this change how you and your family travel now?
We love Boston. Every time we've gone, we've stayed in a Sonder property. It was a cool way to book a room. I really enjoyed it. Am I going to say, oh, I'm never staying at Marriott property again? Well, you don't have a whole lot of choices because it's everything out there is probably either a Marriott or a Hilton or one of the large chains. So, you know, I'm going to chalk it up to a fun experience. It was bizarre. But this was employee terminations and a business separation, and then a whole lot of third-party travelers that were affected by it. So,
well, Paul, I'm glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
All right. Take care.
Paul Strack booked a room in Boston through the now bankrupt rental company Sonder. We reached him in North Little Rock, Arkansas. Classic song about a dude who simply must be on his way. Thanks for the love, girl, but he can't hang around. He's as free as a bird, and that bird can't change because, well, he doesn't really explain. One common theory is that he could change, but he doesn't really feel like it, and he's never considered feeling like it. Of course, some birds really cannot change. You can clip their wings, ask them who's a pretty bird repeatedly, and give them an extra helping of flamingo pellets, but if they stayed at your sanctuary, things just couldn't be the same. That's why on November 2nd, Frankie, a four-month-old flamingo who'd been born at the Paradise Park Wildlife Sanctuary in Cornwall, England, decided she had to be traveling on now. As I mentioned, her wings had been clipped to prevent her from taking off, but Frankie took off anyway. And as she flew and landed and flew again, reported sightings and blurry paparazzi-style snapshots poured in, culminating eventually in slightly out-of-focus photos of a flamingo cavorting in the surf nearly 200 kilometers away off the coast of France. Well, that was 3 days ago, and now Paradise Park has confirmed it. It's Frankie, and they're going to let her be free. The curator of the park says he's worried about her, but, quote, all the evidence that we have seen of her in France shows a well-adjusted, well-fed bird doing extremely well, unquote. So she's free as a bird now, and that bird you cannot change. Frankie the flamingo is in the pink of health, and experts will be keeping an eye on her for the foreseeable fuchsia. Here's Holly Cole with Where Flamingos Fly.
Oh, I think I'll go where flamingos fly, where the sun hangs low in a ruby sky, and the surf at night sings a lullaby. Well, I think I'll go where flamingos fly. That's the place for me, where the waving palms kiss a sultry sea, and a million stars light the velvet sky. Yes, I think I'll go.
Holly Cole with Where Flamingos Fly.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, a new LNG project in BC has some key First Nations approval, but it also is facing opposition from several other First Nations. One opponent tells us why they plan to keep fighting the Prime Minister's push to fast-track the project.
And on the 10th anniversary of the attack on the Bataclan Theatre in Paris, the father of one of the victims reflects on how the city is remembering the tragedy and why he decided not to attend the remembrance ceremonies.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For I've got to go where flamingos fly.
It is 6:35, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River / Dead Set with Steve Ross. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. Do you rely on KAXE? Are you at least 70 and a half years old? Supporting KAXE's future is easy. Ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to KAXE. Questions? Call Chris at 218-326-1234. Looking at weather tonight, mostly clear skies, lows 29 to 34 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs 54 to 60, south winds 10 to 20.
It's been touted as a win for reconciliation, but some BC First Nations are not so sure. As you heard earlier in the show, Prime Minister Mark Carney was in Terrace, BC today to announce several projects he's recommending for fast-tracked approval by the Major Projects Office. Among them is the Salisms LNG project. It's backed by the Nisga Nation, and on completion, it would be capable of producing 12 million tons of liquefied natural gas per year. Here's Mr. Carney discussing that project at the announcement today.
It'll also be one of the world's cleanest LNG operations, with emissions an incredible 94% below the global average, with the potential to reach net zero by the end of this decade. All while creating thousands of skilled careers and $4 billion contributions annually to our GDP.
As I mentioned, the Nisga Nation is a partner in the project, but other First Nations in BC are not. Tara Marsden is the WILP Sustainability Director for the Gitignau Hereditary Chiefs, who are among the leaders opposing the project. We reached her in New Hazleton, BC.
Tara, that's a bit of what the Prime Minister has said about this project. What does it signify to you?
Well, it's unfortunate that the Prime Minister has not gotten a good fact check on the project in terms of climate and in terms of Indigenous support for it. So it is unfortunate that he traveled all this way to our region and didn't reach out to those who've raised concerns and try and include us in that conversation. Just on the net zero claims, that net zero target is only reached if they can get the electricity from the North Coast Transmission Line, which they also announced today. And when we analyze the climate claims of Salisms, it really is based on an approach called project splitting. So project splitting is where you take in isolation the terminal, and then you take in isolation the pipeline, and then you take in isolation the gas extraction, the fracking, and then also the shipping and the burning of gas once it gets to its destination. So if you add it all up, which some people have, and created a bit of an estimate formula, it could be a lot higher than what Prime Minister Carney reported today in Terrace.
Gitignau Hereditary Chiefs previously argued that they were not adequately consulted on this project, but a judge, as you know, ruled in the province's favor in that case. So where do you go from here?
Yes, it was a disappointing result in court. We're not done our efforts to protect the salmon, especially, and to protect our climate. So Gitignau has been affected by climate, as many people have globally. We have experienced drought, we've experienced wildfire, and we're seeing our glaciers potentially melting to the point of complete loss by the end of this century. So this is not over for us. We will continue to support those who have active cases, like L'Aquilams and Metlakatla, who just filed in federal court.
There is backing for this project by the Nisga Nation in particular. Its president, Eva Clayton, has said it represents a, quote, transformational opportunity, unquote, and goes on to say it will be in line with her nation's environmental standards. What would you say, Tara, to people, including First Nations, who see this as a win?
You know, I would never stand in the way of a nation wanting to achieve self-determination and economic certainty and development for their people and for their lands. But when you propose a project that affects so many others, you have to be inclusive. And if you don't have consensus, then you're simply repeating what colonial governments have been doing for centuries, which is running roughshod over Indigenous rights and a complete disregard for the environment.
If we think of the Prime Minister's announcement as looking at a best case scenario, and what you and others who are concerned as you are of looking at a different scenario, potentially a worst case scenario, is there a middle ground? Can you see a project like this actually helping? What would it take to get there for you?
I think that it's not really about best and worst case scenario. It's more about evidence-based decision making. And so when I mentioned the project splitting that happens, we raised that as early as 2014 when we said we need a full cost accounting. We asked for 10 years. This is not a difficult exercise. It's just that government has no interest in disclosing that information. And so we need to have an agreement first on the information that's being provided to make these decisions. And then we can decide, are we, you know, a little more risk averse or are we more risk tolerant? But at this point on climate, provincial government, federal government, Nishkalisms, they have not done that full cost accounting. And we are using, like I said, an internationally kind of recognized formula mm-hmm. as a substitute. But there is no reason why those people who are interested in this project couldn't provide that information.
So you said this is not over for you. You've hinted at more to come. What do you do tomorrow and the day after?
So currently we are exploring the cumulative effects for the PRGT pipeline. So this is one of the permit requirements with the BC Energy Regulator. So this is going to be our opportunity to do a really robust cumulative effects assessment that's Indigenous-led with nations who are directly on the pipeline route. So that's going to be a big task and a big undertaking that's going to help inform what many have already admitted within government, that their certificates are out of date. They were authorized in 2015. A lot has changed on the landscape in terms of cumulative effects. So that's one thing that we're going to be working on. We're also going to be outreaching to potential financiers and investors in the terminal and let them know that there are risks, environmentally, risks to infringements of Indigenous rights, but also the risk to the Nisga'a Nation as well, as they are, you know, not experienced in the LNG industry. And as we are seeing, there's going to be a supply glut. So an overabundance of LNG globally has been predicted. And what will happen to these more vulnerable communities who've taken out huge amounts of loans to finance their equity, and then prices drop significantly?
I would imagine, I can't speak for the president of the Nisga'a Nation, as we mentioned, but I would imagine she would take issue at some of what you're saying there. Have you spoken and raised your concerns with the president directly?
Yes, not with the president, but with their senior staff. We let them know that there's a significant risk that they may not have the support that they assume. And we told them, you know, this is a risky project to take on. And then, of course, we were not heard because they went ahead and purchased PRGT and proceeded with Sealisms.
Tara, I appreciate this. I'm glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Tara Marsden is the WILP Sustainability Director for the Gitanyal Hereditary Chiefs. We reached her in New Hazelton, BC. For decades, Wayne Gretzky has been more than a hockey player. He's been a symbol of Canadian pride. But over the past few months, he has been on thin ice up here. Criticism of Mr. Gretzky started during the Four Nations face-off in February. That's the tournament where Canada and the U.S. faced off amid talk from President Trump about turning Canada into the 51st state. So Canadian hockey fans were not thrilled when Wayne Gretzky, Canada's honorary captain that night, walked out from the U.S. tunnel wearing a suit instead of a Canadian jersey and gave a thumbs up to the American bench. Before that, Mr. Gretzky and his wife attended Mr. Trump's inauguration ceremony in January and visited the president several times at his home at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. In an episode of the 100% Hockey podcast yesterday, Mr. Gretzky said he's still a proud Canadian and always will be, even if his friendship with U.S. President Donald Trump has some fans confused.
Canadians are proud. But here's the two factors. You know, I don't know how many people move to the U.S., whether it's business, entertainment, hockey. And I don't know the exact number, but I would tell you that over 90% of them become American citizens. I never became an American citizen. I'm Canadian. I can't vote in the U.S. because I live in the U.S. and I'm Canadian. I can't vote in Canada because I don't live in Canada. I'm not into politics. And so I can't stop the prime minister for saying something. I can't stop the president for saying something. I just kind of like, well, I'm just a hockey player. Simple as that.
You're a voice that people want to hear from. You do understand. you do understand that. You do.
Sure. But as I said to the prime minister, you know, he wouldn't tell me how to play hockey. I'm not going to tell him what to do in politics. Simple as that.
By the way, is it true that Justin called you?
Yes.
Saying he supported you?
It was a wonderful phone call that he reached out, and he gave me a great line. He said, "I'm giving you a hug call." I said, "Okay, I needed it right now." So anyway, I understand. Canadians are proud. Simple as that.
But it kind of hurt me.
I told him, "We'll make the United States the 12th province." So
I don't mind that.
Just tell Donald that, okay, Wayne? Just tell Donald that.
Did it hurt a little bit though, Wayne?
Oh, you know, people are going to say and believe what they want, right? Bottom line is, I know in my heart I'm Canadian, stayed Canadian, Canadian citizen for life, and simple as that.
That was Wayne Gretzky talking to co-hosts John Shannon and Darren Millard on the 100% Hockey podcast this week. French President Emmanuel Macron made a grim pilgrimage across Paris today. Along with family members of the victims, he visited every site where Islamic State gunmen committed their massacres 10 years ago today, culminating in an attack on the Bataclan Theater. The attackers killed 137 people, including 90 at the Bataclan. Tonight, church bells rang out across the capital to mark the beginning of the attack, and the Eiffel Tower has been lit in the colors of the French flag. Stéphane Sarad is the father of Hugo Sarad, a 23-year-old who was killed at the Bataclan. We reached him in Paris.
Stéphane, how do you mark this day?
Today is obviously a complicated day because it's a kind of tragic anniversary. And all the victims, the survivors that miss someone, we are sure that we will have to face for another time. We have to face the reality of the loss, the reality of the attentat, and it was quite hard to prepare ourselves to this day.
You did not go to the ceremony at the Bataclan. Why?
No, I did not, because in fact, 10 years ago, after the funerals of my son, Hugo, I was invited in the ceremony in the Invalides. And it was so painful for me to attend this ceremony because I felt very, very, very sad and lonely. And that's the reason why, since that ceremony, I didn't attend any ceremony. Of course, I'm invited, but I'm not really able to attend those ceremonies. I never went to Bataclan. I never went to the place for the victim. I'm not able to go there. And in the same idea, for several years, I'm not able to go to the cemetery in south of France where is Hugo, because for me, Hugo is not there. He's not in the Bataclan, he's not in cemetery, he's somewhere else.
On days like this, it's almost inescapable. There are ceremonies, there are news reports. You can see the Eiffel Tower from your home.
Yeah.
And then you know, it's lit up to pay tribute to your son and the others who were killed. So how do you deal with that every year?
I think we used to do that now for every year, but 10 years, it's a kind of symbolic anniversary date. It started not today, it started several days before. So yes, we know that we are trapped. We are surrounded by that. And my way to manage that, because I was able to think that it would arrive, and therefore I wrote a book several months ago, that was published last month. And the name is At the End of the Grief, explaining what I did have to face, my wife, my son. And I also explained the 10 years following the Bataclan tragedy for my son, and all the people I met and all the humanity I met, allowing me to achieve a kind of resilience. Am I at the end of the grief? No, because I think you never reach the end of the grief. You only have, because it's not a destination, it's a travel. And you have to travel with your pain, with your grief. And that I understood after 10 years of working about the situation.
It's with you always. It changes. You learn to deal with it in different ways. What would you like people to know about Hugo?
He was a young adult, full of life, full of music. He had a lot of expectation for the future. He wanted to finish and to achieve university in Japan, and he had a lot of dreams. And I just would like that people remain those dreams, and those dreams are not dead with him.
How is your wife doing? How's the rest of your family doing 10 years on?
My ex-wife is still living in Montpellier. So, of course, she had also to follow her own travel of resilience. My wife in Paris, and I've got a little son, 12 years old. We also have to learn how to live with that, without the fear of going to a cinema, to a movie theater, to a concert, to continue to have a normal life, going to the restaurant, to the terrace in Paris. So we had to learn to go back to that.
Have you learned that? Do you feel safer now? Because we know officials have said they've stopped other plots from being carried out. You know,
yes,
do you feel
right.
safer now?
Yes, we have to feel safe, because if we live in the fear, they will win, because terrorists, they want to have a fear, and people afraid of doing everything. And if we don't live our own life, if we stop to go to the movie theater, to the terrace, then that's the end of our culture, of our history, and the end of freedom. So yes, you're right. We know that we are facing a changing way of possible tourism in France, because now it's younger people that are that intend to go to those tragedy. So of course we have to be aware of that, but we have to continue. And it took me 2 years before being able to go in a concert hall for a jazz concert with Lisa Ekdahl, which is a wonderful jazz singer. It took me 2 years to be ready to go there, but now I usually go there and I don't feel fear.
Stéphane, thank you for coming back on the show. I appreciate this.
Thank you very much.
Stéphane Sarad is the father of Hugo Sarad, a 23-year-old who was killed in the 2015 Bataclan attack. We reached him in Paris. So much for thank you for your service. Earlier this year, the U.S. Defense Department effectively banned all transgender service members from duty. A few months after that, those transgender members who had already been forced out of service and had opted to retire were told they would be getting no retirement benefits. Now, 17 trans members of the Air Force and Space Force are suing the Trump administration, saying it stripped the plaintiffs of their health insurance and $1 to $2 million U.S. in pension benefits. In August, we spoke with the lead plaintiff, Master Sergeant Logan Ireland. He served in the U.S. Air Force for 15 years and was told he was no longer eligible for early retirement. Here's part of his conversation with As It Happens guest host Rebecca Zandbergen from our archives.
I felt disheartened. I felt betrayed. You know, I plan to do 20-plus years in the Air Force. I didn't have a plan to retire. But when, you know, news came down via the executive orders that, you know, I would have to exit the military, when I received my early retirement, I felt that I was being given a sense of closure from the Air Force. You know, if I couldn't continue to serve, at least I'd be able to achieve a full retirement. And now that has been taken from me, and I just feel a great sense of loss.
Until the start of this year, what had been your experience in the Air Force? Did you feel welcome? Did you feel a part of the team? Did you feel like, and I know the accolades that you have, and you've achieved much in the Air Force, but what was your experience like?
You know, I entered the Air Force back in 2010, and since then, I've been able to serve authentically. The Air Force helped me find my voice. It brought me to, you know, friends that I now call family. It gave me my, you know, education. It let me travel the world. It's a cornerstone of who I am. I am an airman first. I raise my right hand. I put on the same uniform as anybody else in the Air Force. I've been given nothing but support since I've been in. And it has nothing to do with me being transgender. People see my service as honorable. They see it as meritorious. And they want to support that. And all that I've continued to do throughout my military experience has been try to make the Air Force better for those who will one day take my place.
What do you do now when you don't have the retirement you banked on for so long? I mean, what is your future for you and your wife look like?
So, you know, the one thing that the military didn't teach me how to do is how to retreat. So we continue to fight forward. We stand side by side with each other, my wife and I and other trans service members. We'll see what the next step, you know, takes us. But at least for me, I know that any step that I take moving forward has the potential to impact trans service members who will come after me when we repeal this policy.
From our archives, Master Sergeant Logan Ireland talking to As It Happens guest host Rebecca Zandbergen in August.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
And you are tuned to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 in Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. I'm Steve Ross. I'm your volunteer host tonight. I'll be here until 10 o'clock. I got an hour's worth of On the River, bring you some music from people like Greg Brown, Dave Ray, Dan Hicks, some Bobby Black doing some great pedal steel stuff, and actually some Jackson Brown and David Lindley. Warren Zevon, he's just put in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, so that's coming up in your first hour. Then 8 o'clock, we'll bring you the Dead Set, Music of the Grateful Dead, and the related bands. So that goes from 8 to 10. Got a great show coming your way. Give you a weather forecast here tonight before.